I'd like to welcome everyone here this evening. On behalf of Bar-Ilan University and the Cleveland College of Jewish Studies, I'm Joe Shaffrin, co-chair of Cleveland Friends of Bar-Ilan. A couple of announcements before I get into the introduction of our speaker this evening. First of all, from the college, to be on the lookout for the college's spring semester catalog in the January 4th edition of the Cleveland Jewish News. We invite you to learn with us through a wide variety of offerings, Cleveland classes, Lehrhaus mini courses, and a four-part lecture series examining the topic American Jewry in Israel, Does the Love Affair Still Exist? With speakers Deborah Lipstadt, Noam Zion, Jack Wertheimer, and Dennis Prager. Also, this Tuesday evening, December 4th, the Cleveland College of Jewish Studies Association is holding a B'nai Bash for books to benefit the college's Aaron Garber Library. The program includes dinner and a silver salute to a golden tradition presented by Dorothy and Reuben Silver. For information, call the college office tomorrow at 464-4050 or see Gloria Kahan or Mildred Rosenberg or Lucille Gross at the reception which follows this evening's speech. Following the lecture this evening, as is always the format here, there will be an opportunity for questions and responses, and there will be a reception and refreshments following the event. It is my pleasure on behalf of the Cleveland Friends of Bar-Ilan University to introduce Dr. Aryeh A. Frimmer, the Ethel and David Resnick Professor in Active Oxygen Chemistry and Chairman of the Chemistry Department at Bar-Ilan. Professor Frimmer graduated in 1969 from Brooklyn College with a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry, summa cum laude with Department Honors. At the same time, he received rabbinical ordination from Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael in Brooklyn and completed his graduate work with Paul D. Bartlett at Harvard University in 1974. During his stay at Harvard, he was also the Associate Director of the Hillel Foundation and the first Orthodox rabbi to hold that post. He then crossed the ocean to become a Weizmann postdoctoral fellow with Dov Echud at the Weizmann Institute, and in 1975, he joined the faculty of Bar-Ilan University. In addition to his duties at Bar-Ilan, he served as visiting scientist at the medical department of Brookhaven National Laboratories, as well as guest editor for two issues of the Israel Journal of Chemistry on active oxygen. In 1985, the Chemical Rubber Company published his four-volume series on singlet O2. Professor Frimmer has published close to 60 articles, reviews, and books, and has given presentations at more than 40 scientific meetings. He's in Cleveland for a sabbatical year, working at NASA's Lewis Research Center. And it is with great pleasure at this time that I present you Professor Aryeh A. Frimmer.
That Goldstein reminded me of a beautiful response to such a beautiful welcome and introduction. My father would have been proud. My mother believes every word. Firstly, allow me to thank the Friends of Bar-Ilan and the Cleveland College of Jewish Studies for inviting me to speak this evening on women and minions. I don't know what you expect to hear. I hope to give you some insight, some understanding, perhaps break a little bit of new ground, but hopefully we'll learn together. I'm sure some of you are asking yourself why a professor of chemistry was chosen to speak on this particular problem of halakha, of traditional Jewish law. However, this, more than anything else, reflects the uniqueness of Bar-Ilan University on the Israel front. Bar-Ilan is an institution which prides itself both on its commitment to excellence in scientific research and in its devotion to Jewish scholarship and tradition. Allow me to begin my talk this evening with a short but an important introduction. In dealing with the status of women in halakha, in Jewish law, it is eminently clear that Jewish law assumed a social order in which women and men played different roles. The man's role has traditionally been the more public, aggressive role, while that of women has been more private, more family-centered. It should be noted, however, that just because two roles are not identical does not mean they're not equally important. Two people need not have the same profession so that both lead meaningful lives. Similarly, a Cohen or a common Israelite need not have the same religious obligations for both roles to be of equal importance and of equal value. It is true, the role of the priest, the role of the Kohen, has more specific commandments and is indeed more sanctified. But that doesn't mean it's more important. From a religious perspective, what ultimately determines whether a role is important or gives the importance of the role is what the Creator wants me to do. God does not want me, an Israelite, to play the role of a priest or vice versa. Let's also not confuse the importance of a role and the covet, the honor that comes with the role. The more honored or public role is not necessarily the more important role. The Queen of England, and I hope there's nobody here from Britain, the Queen of England is a case in point. Hers is a public role with great honor and majesty, yet of little importance in molding the future of her country. All this is a long-winded way of saying that just because the man's role has more specific obligations and is a more public role, traditionally, does not mean that it is the more important role in the divine scheme of things. On the contrary, Judaism views both roles as complementary and of equal value. But there's a hitch. Brother Saul Berman, in a seminal article in Tradition on the Standing of Women in Jewish Law, notes that in contradistinction to the roles of Kohen, priest, and Israelite, the traditional woman's role is neither binding nor exclusive. Rather, it is a preferred and protected role. I use the word preferred in contradistinction to the word mandated. Had the Torah intended to preclude from women all roles but wife, mother, and homemaker? It had the means of doing so. After all, the Torah knows how to obligate and prescribe. For example, the Torah in Exodus 21 prescribes the obligations of a husband to a wife as she'er, sut, v'onah, food, clothing, and conjugal relations. Interesting, in Judaism, conjugal relations is an obligation of the husband to the wife, not vice versa. Similarly, the law prescribes the obligations of a father to a child, support, education, to marry the children off, to teach them a trade or occupation, to circumcise males and redeem firstborn, and even to teach the children how to swim. Similarly, the law gives a whole series of obligations to children regarding the respect and honor of their parents. Well, had the Torah wanted to require women to lock them into the role of mother, wife, or maker, it could have mandated that women not only marry and procreate, but give them an entire range of household duties. This would clearly have defined a clear, distinct role for women. Yet surprisingly, women are either obligated to marry, although there is clear and great social pressure to do so, nor are women obligated to have children. They're not obligated in the midst of pur or rule, although most women opt and feel the need to do so. Nor do women have specific household duties. Yet it is also clear that while not demanding adherence to one particular role, the voluntary selection of the role of mother, wife, and homemaker was preferred, encouraged, and halakhically protected. And this is the important point. The Torah halakhically protected this role by freeing women from positive commandments which are time and determined. Mitzvot aseh shazman rama. This category of positive biblical or rabbinic commandments from which women are freed includes those which come from time to time and demand fulfillment at a particular time or during a particular time frame. Examples include Shofar, Rosh Hashanah, Sukkah, Lulav, Tzitzit. Women have asked to voluntarily keep many of them, but they're not obligated to do so. Now, this category, there are many exceptions where women are obligated, mostly with their commandments, like Kiddush, Megillah, Hanukkah, in which women are obligated, although these are mitzvahs that come from time to time. Nevertheless, there's a special, unique reason in each case. So women are freed from commandments that require observance at a particular time. Women are also free from commandments such as public prayer, which would force them to leave the home and require a communal appearance. In short, then, the halacha allowed a woman. Jewish law gave women, Jewish women, the flexibility to fulfill the mitzvah or to devote herself to her home, her family, and her children, should she choose to do so. Raising her children as solid, knowledgeable, practicing Jews for thousands of years gave the Jewish mother honor and ego satisfaction. Parnassa, making a living, politics, shul, community life, even the Talmudic mental gymnastics, those were to be her husband's worries. Her job was to raise the next generation willing and able to carry on the torch of tradition. Yet, as we look at Jewish history over the past 1,000 years, and more particularly over the past 150 years, and perhaps even more particularly, most dramatically over the last 50 years, we see a slow but gradual change in the givens of Jewish life. Today we are witness to the fact that religious women mix and compete freely with men in the marketplace and the business world. We find women after high school spending a good deal of time in institutions of higher secular and religious learning. There is no religious girl nowadays who doesn't spend a year or two or three in advanced study in Eretz Israel or at home. We find halakhically committed women becoming involved in politics and religious community life. This was unthinkable 100 years ago. What brought about these changes? I'm neither a historian nor a sociologist. But it is clear that the major factors were economics, making up another, and the changing attitude towards women in the non-Jewish world. Clearly, persecution and poverty forced the Jewish woman out of her home and out of her fortress into the public thoroughfare, so that the Jewish mother was forced not only to be a good educator, but a successful handler, businesswoman as well. In addition, as we move to the modern period, upward mobility and financial security could only be obtained through a university education. This is a lesson the Jews learned fast. Gradually, Jewish women and men learned to compete not only for money, but for grades as well. These women, who have shown their excellence in business and in secular scholarship, began to yearn for greater involvement in all aspects of religious life as well, be it scholarship, ritual, or leadership. Now, as long as the challenge to the existing norms came from those who rejected and were not fundamentally committed to Jewish law, it was not taken seriously by the religious authorities. True, Maimonides has said, Kabel ha'emek minisham ro, accept truth, whatever its source. Nevertheless, packaging has a strong influence on the consumer. Once these very same desires were expressed by religiously committed women, religiously committed mothers, the halakhic establishment was forced to consider the question much more seriously. The response, of course, has not been uniform. There are many amongst the lay and rabbinic leadership who have battled against all change. After all, for 2,000 years, good Jewish women have followed a tried and tested recipe for success. Why change now? After all, the need for solid, committed Jewish children has not changed over the past year. Any tampering with a woman's role may weaken and the result may be catastrophic for the Jewish community. There were other poskim, other religious decisors, however, who realized that the upheavals in values and norms that occurred in the 19th and 20th centuries had been so sweeping that we can no longer turn the clock of history backwards. Nor can we resurrect the simplistic innocence when we're one past. If a religious woman wants firm Jewish involvement and expression, then halakhic Judaism ought to try to meet the challenge. This doesn't mean that we should stop educating our daughters in the importance and the centrality of the family, and in the importance of raising children as one of the major goals of a Jewish woman's life. But it does mean that we must recognize that there are other goals for women, and furthermore, that there is a need for women to have more religious content, more solid religious content, so that they will be able to benefit from the existing reality. It is with this view that I personally agree, and it is with this view that I assume my lecture from the audience. Now, with the 50 minutes remaining to me, I certainly don't have sufficient time to discuss all that can and should be done in response to this challenge. That would take me a series of lectures for a year. Because in order to change, one has to be educated. I do, however, believe that the correct response will be a mix of education and creativity. It is only from a position of scholarship and earnestness that we can be sure that our queries are valid and confident that our creativity will not violate the rubric and guidelines of Allah. For ultimately, our desire should be to fulfill the divine will. I also firmly believe that much of the dissatisfaction expressed by women regarding their status in Jewish law stems from a lack of understanding of the halakha's intention, motivation, and priorities. They may not be the same as 20th century humanist values. Once this can be lucidly understood and explained, then one may be willing to live with the problem. Note, I didn't say you would necessarily be happy, but at least you wouldn't find the status quo so objectionable. For the past 20 years, I've been studying what I believe to be one of the central issues raised in regard to the status of women in Jewish law, namely the inclusion of women in a minyan, which is most of you know as the minimum quorum of 10 individuals required for many religious rituals. And I'd like to share some of my insights with you this evening. A full presentation of my findings are published in the summer 1980 volume of Tradition. The story begins with a Mishnah in the Talmudic tractate Megillah, which lists those rituals requiring the quorum of 10. Now the Mishnah reads in part as follows. When less than 10 are present, we do not appoint a cantor, a chazan, to lead the public prayer rituals of Kaddish, Kedusha, Boruch Hu, or the repetition of the Amida, which is the essential tefillah in the prayer service, with Kedusha. Nor do the Kohen and the priest bless the congregation. Nor do we read from the Torah or the prophets in public with the appropriate benediction. Nor do we say the Sheva Brachot, the seven nuptial blessings. Nor do we do Zimun B'Shem. We do not introduce the grace after meal with the name of God, Elohim. In addition to the rituals mentioned in the Mishnah, the sages require the minyan in a variety of other rituals, some of them being the recitation of the Birkat HaGomel, which is a special benediction of thanks recited upon being saved from a life-threatening experience, such as childbirth, an operation, or a serious illness, or a serious traffic accident. Secondly, there is the reading of the Megillah, with the concluding Haravet Riveni benediction. There is the lighting of the candles in the synagogue, and of the Hanukkah candles in the synagogue. And finally, there are the special laws of public martyrdom, which come into effect when the union is present, and I'll discuss these different rituals as we proceed. Now the question of women in minyan stems from the fact that the vast majority of public prayer rituals, including the recitation of the Kaddish, Kedusha, Brochu, and the repetition of the Chazan, are referred to as Dvarim Shebekdusha, public acts or declarations of heavenly sanctification, where we sanctify God's name. And the ruling is unanimous that the quorum for Dvarim Shebekdusha must consist of 10 male adults, to the exclusion of women and minors. That's where the problem is. Now remember, public prayer is a rabbinic institution. In the first temple, there was no public, there was no prayer service. Public prayer came in as a rabbinic institution introduced by Ezra and the men of the Great Assembly at the beginning of the Second Temple period. And it is therefore of interest to understand what is the rationale behind these rulings. Furthermore, not everything required in the minyan is a davar shebekdusha, as an act of sanctification of God's name. For example, the seven nuptial blessings are benedictions of joy and praise, and talk little of God's sanctity. Similarly, the reading of the Torah and the Haftarah were instituted partly by Moses and later by Ezra to serve as public learning sessions. Reading the Megillah and the kindling of the Hanukkah lights in the synagogue and the Hagomel blessing all are to publicize God's salvation of his people. What are the rules in these cases? May women be counted by themselves or together with men for these rituals? Ladies and gentlemen, my father once told me of a beautiful story of a Southern Baptist minister who was known far and wide for being a wonderful, wonderful preacher and an outstanding teacher. And when they asked him, why are you such a good teacher? He said his father in a Southern drawl, first I tell them what I go on and tell them, and then I tell them what I tell them, and then I tell them what I told them. What I'm going to do now is first I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to give you the outline of the different views of minyan that I sort of pity for. Then we're going to analyze, then I'm going to tell you what I told you. I'm going to analyze it in depth, and we're going to understand each. And then we're going to have a summary and see, Congress, what do we learn from this? So now I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. Now, an examination of the many sources concerning the participation of women in minyan revealed fundamentally three schools of thought. The first school of thought contains that women may participate in a minyan. Again, the first school of thought maintains that women may participate in a minyan whenever their obligation is equal to that of men. The second school of thought maintains that women can never count for a minyan. And the third school of thought makes a distinction between two types of minyan. There is a minyan needed for a public service, and the minyan is a prerequisite for this public service, then women can count. But if the purpose of the minyan is to publicize the performance of a particular act, then women can count. In short, yes, no, maybe. Now let's analyze the first school of thought. The first school of scholars defines minyan as 10 individuals of equal maximal obligation. Okay? 10 people of equal maximal obligation. Accordingly, women cannot constitute a minyan, whether together with men or wholly by themselves, whenever they are not obligated, or even if they are obligated but lack the maximal obligation. On the other hand, in all mitzvot, in all performances, either biblical or rabbinic, when women share equally with men in the maximal obligation, they can count with men. Now the problem is, do they count together? Do they count separately? Is an issue we'll talk about towards the end of the lecture. But they can count for men. The 13th century codifier Rabbi Nachum HaMeiri says as follows: in matters that require 10, There are those who claim that since the obligation of women is equal to that of men, they may constitute the quorum. And on many, many codifiers, I would maintain that there is about nearly half of all the codifiers that I've gone through, maybe even the majority, that hold this particular view. And for the sake of clarity, we're going to take ritual by ritual and explain the ritual, explain whether why women count or don't count in this particular ritual based on this first school of thought and how the school understands that particular ritual. Let's begin with public prayer. Because that, unfortunately, or fortunately, is the major, the crux of the problem. Now, even though prayer is a positive rabbinic commandment, which is kind of determined because you have to daven the morning prayer in the morning, the afternoon in the afternoon, and there's a rule about when you can do it. You can't do it any time you want to. So it's a positive commandment, which is kind of determined. And normally you would say women are free from prayer. The answer is no, women are not free from prayer. The Talmud tells us because prayer is a request for heavenly mercy. Rachamim. It's a request for mercy, for rachamim. And therefore, women are obligated. But when it comes to public prayer, I already noted that since public prayer would force the women to come out of the home, the rabbis freed women of this obligation. But in doing so, okay? In doing so, by saying that women are freed from public prayer, they no longer have the obligation of public prayer, and therefore cannot count for a minute for public prayer. Now, what does public prayer include? It includes everything that goes on in the shul, essentially. Kaddish, Kedusha, Brachu, the repetition of the Shemona Esrei with Kedusha. These are the services which are essential to the public prayer. Since women are free from the obligation, they can't count for me. Rabbi Margolio, who was an outstanding scholar of the 20th century, says as follows. Public martyrdom, in whose quorum women may be counted, we'll talk about a little bit later, is not comparable to public prayer. A woman may not participate in the minyan for public prayer because she's not obligated. Now, the status of women in this particular halacha is comparable to a particular man in a particular situation. This is what's called the oneg. An oneg is a mourner between the hours of death and burial. Now, an oneg is freed, male, is freed from all positive commands, men and women alike, an oneg or an oneg. Now, an oneg, a man, who after the death, before the burial of a close relative, is free from public prayer. He, such a man, cannot count for a minyan because he's free from public prayer. Interestingly, the codifiers discuss the question whether he can say Kaddish. Can he go to shul and say Kaddish? The codifiers say, the majority seem to say, yes, he can go to shul and say Kaddish, and for that Kaddish he counts. He's obligated, if he can participate, yes, then he can. But since when he's free, he doesn't count. Again, we see the interrelationship between obligation and need. Let's talk about reading of the Torah. The majority opinion is that women are freed from the obligation of reading of Kriyat HaTorah. A man must, on Monday and Thursday and the Sabbath, is required to hear the reading of the Torah. Women are free from this obligation. And therefore, says the first school, women can't count for minyan for reading of the Kriyat HaTorah. There's an interesting problem with regard to one Torah reading, that is Parshat Zachor. You may know that before Purim, and Shabbat Zachor, the Shabbat of remembrance, we are obligated biblically, the rabbi set the time, but there's a biblical obligation, to read, to remember that which the Amalekites did to us as we left Egypt. They attacked us. We weren't prepared. And we read this before Purim because Haman was an Amalekite. The question is, are women obligated in this reading of the Torah? Now the consensus of authority is that women are free from this obligation. Why? Because to remember what the Amalekites did had a purpose. It was a call to war. To remember the Amalekites and to go to war against them. where we were freed from the obligation of active war, where we had to be supported, and therefore, said the most codified, women are freed from real Parshat Zachor. Other authorities maintain, no, that women are obligated, which represents the majority opinion, that women are obligated. The noted scholar, the Chatam Sofer, who is one of the pillars of Jewish law, says that since women are obligated in Parshat Zachor, never heed a minority view, but he says, since women are obligated in Parshat Zachor, and they have to hear the Torah background reading, they count for many professions. So let's talk about reading the Megillah. Women are obligated to hear Megillah just like men. We have to remember the poor story of Mordecai and Esther. However, it's a positive commandment which is time determined, and there is a dispute amongst the authorities whether women have the same obligation as men do. The Halakha Gedolot and Moshe Ashkenazi Palestinian say that the women's obligation is lesser than that of men. And I have no time to go into the details. It's a very complicated discussion. The Rambam and many Sephardi Muslims hold that the obligation of women is exactly like men. Says the Rambam, who maintains that the women's obligation is equal and maximal to that of men. There is an opinion that although women may let me say one other word of introduction. Normally, when we read the Megillah, if a woman or a man does not have the Megillah, surely can read it at home privately. You don't have to have a meaning. It's preferable. However, when we read the Megillah not in its proper time, for instance, you know that in Israel, it doesn't happen here, but it's put in the States, never falls out on Shabbos. But in Israel, the 15th, you know, in Jerusalem, you read in Walton, you read on the 15th of Adar, not the 14th of Adar, and the 15th of Adar can fall on Shabbat. When the 15th of Adar falls out on Shabbat, those in Jerusalem read it the day before on the 14th. They don't read in its proper time. The Lord dictates when you read it, not in its proper time, you have to have a meaning. The question is, do women count for this meaning? Furthermore, there's a benediction that follows the reading of the Megillah called Harav and Rivenu. That also requires a minyan. I mean, one of the reasons we read the Megillah without Harav and Rivenu. Well, do 10 women constitute a minyan for reading Harav and Rivenu? Says the Ron, since I maintain women's obligation is equal to that of men, yes, women can make the Harav and Rivenu, 10 women, and they can read Megillah not in its appropriate time. Now, this opinion is very important. We'll come back to it later. Another example is Zimun B'Shem. As you know, after a Jew eats a bread meal, if there are three men sitting at the table, or three women sitting at the table, Jewish law dictates that they do a Zimun. There's an introduction about Tayin of Aleph, or three women would say Zimun Tayin of Aleph. And I know I see that some people raising their eyebrow. What do you mean three women make a Zimun? It happens to be, it's the first Mishnah, to the Mishnah, it's the Mishnah. Yes, women, three women make a Zimun. And just as three men do it, three women can do it as well. Two men and a woman or two women and a man don't make a Zimun. They have to be separate. And we'll talk about this point a little bit later on why, because it's relevant to our discussion of meaning. Nevertheless, if there are 10 men present, they say, Mevarech Lelokim Shachar Mishor. They invoke God's name. The question, it could be because when there are men present, there's greater sanctity, they can invoke God's name. The question is, do women, 10 women, would they say Zimun? Do they say Mevarech Lelokim? The Lord, if they don't. And the reason given is because, while the man's Zimun is obligatory, the women's Zimun is says the first school, that's obvious. Since the women here don't carry the obligation that men have, they can't count for the meaning. Let me just conclude this first school with the law of the martyrdom. As we all know, in Judaism, life comes first. That's almost always true. I mean, if someone's life is on the line, they desecrate the Shabbos. And by the way, that's not trivial, because one who violates the Shabbos gets the death penalty. But nevertheless, to save one's life, one is allowed to violate the Shabbos. If someone comes over and says, eat pork, or I'll kill you, a Jew eats pork. Life comes first. There are few exceptions in these rules of martyrdom, and that is by the big three. What are the big three? These are the three commandments which the Jews forbid to violate even at the penalty of being killed. And that is Gilui Aryot, Shlichut Damim, Avodah Zarah. Incestual or adulterous relationships, Gilui Aryot, Shlichut Damim, murder, and idolatry, Avodah Zarah. The Jew said, worship the animal or I'll kill you, he lets himself be killed. That's the idea. Furthermore, if a Jew said he eats pork between himself and the one who was just supposed to get him to violate, he eats pork. But if he's taken out to the marketplace in front of 10 Jews and says, I want you Jew to eat pork, if there's a million present, the Jew's got to bite the bullet and salute the flag. He's got to forfeit his life. In that particular case, he's got to stand up for being Jewish. In public. The question is, do 10 women count for a minion? So the rules change. And the vast majority of codifiers, and clearly codifiers in the first school, say yes. Because women are obligated equally with men in martyrdom, and therefore 10 women make a minion for martyrdom. So again, this whole school that we've seen has argued that whatever women are obligated equally and maximally with men, they indeed do count for a minion. That's the first school. It happens to be a very palatable school. It's a school that I personally happen to prefer. But as a scholar, my personal preference is irrelevant to the truth. I'm presenting it to you as the first school in the question of women and men. Let's move on to the second school. The second school categorically rejects the inclusion of women in a meaning, in any meaning form whatsoever. Now the basis of this opinion is an interesting Talmudic statement, again, which is very complicated. But let me just summarize it for you. The statement found in the Talmud reads as follows. The Gemara there is discussing three women making a zimun, and then discussing the question about two women, two men making a zimun. And the Gemara says as follows, 100 women are like two men. Mea nashe ketrei gavri damri. Now that's not a male chauvinist statement. It is not talking about worth. It is talking about a particular problem of zimun. Let me analyze. Now Rashi, when he analyzes this verse, 100 women are like two men, says the Gemara means as follows. The Gemara is, in that discussion, as probably says as follows. We see that women can make an optional zimun. Three women, though not obligated, three women can make a zimun. What about and three men make an obligatory zimun? Well, what about two men? Can two men make a zimun? Can two men make an optional zimun? Just like women. There is such a concept of men make a zimun, and women, no matter how many women there are, even if there are 100 women, it's still an optional zimun. It doesn't make any obligatory. Maybe, says the Gemara, 100 women would be equivalent to two men. Just as 100 women make an optional zimun, so two men can make an optional zimun. Now, as far as this interpretation of the Talmudic statement, it only refers to zimun, it refers to nothing else. And that is clearly how the first school I mentioned learns this particular Gemara. However, Tosfot on Adnotam says that the Gemara is giving us an insight into counting of women for any form that is necessary other than zimun. And the Gemara is telling us that even if there are 100 women, it does not create a minion obligation. Women do not count for minion. And those who subscribe to this second school make things very clearly, whether it be by the Mikra Megillah or Parshat Zakor, or by anything else, and there's a whole list of martyrdom or the like, this school maintains that women do not count for minion, never. There are a variety of explanations, some you will accept, others you probably will not, have been offered as to why the sages chose not to allow women to constitute this minion. And the Yosef Engel maintains, the minion is a concept of community. And community is centered around land. And the land of Israel was given as an inheritance through the men. Since the men are the landed ones, they come to the community, therefore the rabbis chose to concretize this concept of community in the meaning, they chose the men to come for meaning. And the Gedalia Felder suggests a more sociological reason. He suggests that because of woman's obligation to home, she cannot jump to the needs of the community. She has higher and more important needs in the home. And therefore, since they have prior obligations to their families, they cannot be at the beck and call of the community, therefore they do not count for meaning. A more modern approach was suggested by Rabbi Meiselman, who discusses in his book on women in Jewish law, discusses the meaning in the light of role-playing in Jewish law. He offers the opinion that men have been delegated the more public role, which is necessary for the constitutional union, whereas women have been designated the more private role, therefore the rabbis saw fit not to count them in the meaning. All right, that's the second school. Let's move on to the third school. The last school of scholars contends that it is necessary to differentiate between two types of minyanim. Two types of minyanim. Now normally when sages required a minyan of 10 as a prerequisite for the fulfillment of some communal obligation. That is, it's an obligation on the community, not on the individual. It's on the community. And 10 individuals create a community. Now, when there's a community, says this third school, you need 10 men in order to establish the community. However, if the obligation is essentially an individual's obligation, and the purpose of the minyan is merely to publicize the performance of this miracle, of this mitzvah, of this ritual, then women do count. Now, the most classic example, the first one discussed was the reading of Megillah. Reading the Megillah is essentially an individual's obligation. Each individual has the obligation. Preferably, it should be done in the community. Why should it be done in the community? To publicize the miracle of the redemption. But it's an individual's obligation. We do it, the Pesumei Mitzvah, to publicize the miracle. Says the Ramban, therefore the laws are much more lenient. The Ra'ah, who was a talmid, a student of the Ramban, contemporary of the Ramban, says that because the purpose of the Megillah of the Minyan is to publicize, women in fact count. And that in fact there are a great many authorities of the modern day who in fact say that 10 women constitute a minyan for the reading of the Megillah and for the Haravat Rizenu benediction that follows. Now this idea of publicizing the performance has been extended by the Avad Yosef to the kindling of Hanukkah candles and shul. Chabad Yosef, you have 5 men and 5 women in the synagogue, you can kindle Hanukkah lights. A bris, a circumcision, should practically be done for a minyan. And we normally wait till the minyan gathers before we begin the circumcision. Says the Rav Palim, a noted Svai scholar of the last generation, 5 men and 5 women make a minyan for a bris mitzvah. In all these cases, we're dealing with publicizing the miracle. So we have 3 schools. The first school says that women count for minyan whether their obligation is equal to that of men. The second school maintains that women deal with you just very briefly with an interesting problem, which is not discussed until the very modern period. That's the Birkat HaGomel. The Birkat HaGomel is a very unique blessing. It's a blessing which the individual has an opportunity to give thanks to his creator for saving his life. Women who go through childbirth, we know that even in the modern period, there are women who have serious complications after childbirth. It's a life-threatening situation. One who goes through a serious operation, a serious illness, a traffic accident, comes to the synagogue and the presence of 10 says, HaGomel HaYavim Tavot SheGomalani Kol Tov. He's praised to the Lord for saving his life. Men do it all the time. Women rarely do it. It's not the custom. Although the codifiers make it very clear that women are obligated equally with men. And the codifiers are astounded. I mean, these are codifiers that are battling to have women to do something that they're obligated they should do. And said if they're embarrassed to get up in front of the men in the synagogue, they said, let her stand up on the side of the mechitza, on her side of the synagogue, and say them and have everybody here. Or she can, at her home after childbirth, she can gather friends that are having a party in honor of a kiddush, in honor of the birth of the child, or the bris. Let them at that point gather 10 friends together and say, Birkat HaGomel. The question is, do women count for a minyan by Birkat HaGomel? And again, let's analyze it. According to the first school, women share equally in the maximal obligation. They should count. According to the second school, women never count. So don't worry about that school. The third school say if the purpose is to publicize, women count. Well, what is Birkat HaGomel all about? If not to give praise to God and publicize the miracle of a redemption and give public praise. So women should count. And in fact, almost all modern codifiers, this is a problem that was never discussed. Akhtu would say maybe 30 years ago. All modern codifiers, when they discuss the problem, say yes. They say that based on a Mishnah Berurah, who says that you have 9 women and a man, constitute a minyan for Birkat HaGomel. And the analysis is clearly the way I've said. Now my time is running short, but I'd like to just touch on a few more important topics. What is the problem of men and women counting together? Now, can women, when all those cases where the first school and the third school say that women can count together with men, women can count for men. Does that mean they count separately? Or does it mean they can count together with men? 5 men and 5 women. The starting point for this particular discussion is Zimun. I already mentioned to you the 3 men alone can say the Zimun, the introduction to the grace, Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meals. 3 women alone can say the introduction to the grace after meals. But they cannot do it together. And the understanding based on the Mishnah says the women are not to be counted with men for the purpose of Zimun Korban. The question is why? There are a variety of reasons given, as in everything else in Jewish life. Very complicated. It really is. However, the consensus reason given is because it encourages immodesty. So, now what does immodesty mean? The Tashbetz and many other early of the codifiers make it very clear that this is something that's very unique to the meal situation. At a meal situation, in particular their times, you're dealing with something that was with wine, with a lot of drinking going on. They didn't have Coca-Cola. They drank, caramel wine. They drank a lot of wine. It was very, there was a sort of frivolity. There was a joyous atmosphere. The rabbis were afraid that in this particular situation, if you count men and women together, this would encouraging, even in this holy ritual, a certain levity and a frivolity the rabbis were not interested in encouraging. And therefore the rabbis said, men by themselves and women by themselves. But that according to that interpretation, that would be something that's unique to a meal situation. But in any other situation, men and women could count together. In fact, as I mentioned to you, if you go through the modern-day codifiers who discuss this and related problems, for instance, there's Mishnah Berurah, when he talks about Birkat HaGomel, says 9 women and a man. When it comes to the reading of the Megillah, okay, and I'm going to quote 2 names who are known as the extreme right, the Chazon Ish and Rabbi Diskin, Mariel Diskin, who was the head of the Eidah Haredis. In the old Yishuv, they discuss women counting for a minyan by Mikra Megillah. Okay, it's not Ari Yefremov saying this. This is the extreme right. They say that when it comes to Megillah, men, 5 men and 5 women count together for a minyan. Rabbi Avadia Yosef said, 5 men and 5 women can count together for lighting Hanukkah candles.
And in public martyrdom, several of the codifiers can say explicitly, men and women count together for the rules of public martyrdom. So that in fact, men and women can count together for a minyan. The only case where they're required to be separate groups is by the case of the zimun. Now for the Orthodox community, the problem of mechitza is quite important. Because after all, the rules of joining together for a minyan mean that you're in the same location. And a mechitza is a physical barrier. Can men and women on opposite sides of the mechitza join together for a minyan? And the problem, by the way, is not new. The problem is already found in Poland, the Altaheim. They used to have these merchants who would go to the Yerid by train, and the backs of the seats were very high. And all these Jewish merchants are going on the trains to the Yerid, and they get together to daven for a minyan, but the backs of the chairs are very high. And it's like a mechitza, can they daven together? And the codifiers say yes. Since they're in the same area, whose purpose is common, they in fact are allowed to join together in public prayer. And the same thing is true for the case of mechitza, that a mechitza does not interfere. My time has run out, and I want to leave some time for questions, and I'm sure there are issues that I have purposely not covered, and I'll be more than willing to answer them. Some of them are political hot potatoes, and I'm not afraid, so please ask. But let me now just sort of summarize what we've learned. Now it tells them what I told them. We've explored the rules and rationales of minyan eligibility, in particular as it applies to women. We have reaffirmed that women cannot constitute a minyan either alone or together with men, cannot, according to all authorities, for the purpose of public prayer, which includes Kaddish, Kedusha, and Baruch Hu. Now I know that some of you it doesn't make you happy, but hopefully at least you know why. And you know that it's not discriminatory, and you know that the rules are consistent. And the reason why women don't count for a minyan, either because they're not obligated equally for men, or because other views maintain that women don't count for a minyan together with men, but primarily because they're not obligated in these rituals, and you can't count together for a minyan unless you're obligated. However, this does not mean that women and minyan are mutually exclusive. We spent a whole hour tending to demonstrate that that's not true. That certainly according to the first school, if women are obligated equally and maximally with men, they do count for a minyan. And according to the third school, if the purpose of the minyan is to publicize the miracle of performance, women count equally with men. And now, tachlis. The modern day poskim, in discussing this issue, now we're coming down to what's called psak halacha. You know, when the Supreme Court has to make a decision, very often you have seven men sitting on the bench. The majority will agree to a particular opinion for very different reasons, right? But since there's the majority opinion, that's the law. Same thing is true in Judaism. I can hold the first school, I can hold the third school, for a variety of reasons. But if the majority opinion is what holds sway. And therefore, in the following matters, it's clear to the codifiers that women count for a minyan together with men. Megillah and the Haravat Livenu Bracha that follows. And in fact, in many communities, there's a women's service for the reading of Megillah, and women can read the Megillah for themselves and for other women, and can say the Haravat Livenu Bracha afterwards. In the case of public martyrdom, the vast majority of the women count for a minyan. For the Haggadah blessing, there were based on the Mishnah Berurah, many, many codifiers say that women do count for a minyan. In fact, circumcision, where a minyan is preferable, women count for the minyan. And the lighting of the Hanukkah candles, the women can count for a minyan. Now, the implications of this paper to the workings of the women's services of the modern period. This is an interesting innovation where women get together and pray by themselves. Now, I specifically refer to this innovation as the women's services, because as I made very clear, 10 women for public prayer, only for public prayer, do not constitute a minyan. according to traditional Jewish law, because of the fact that women are not obligated in public prayer. So now the question of women's, therefore I refer to this innovation as women's services, because they do not form a meaning for public prayer. Now this innovation deserves long and considered evaluation, and together with my brother I'm now doing the research on a paper which I hope to be published within a period of 6 months to a year in tradition on this particular problem. It's a very complicated issue with most things. There are very few halachic issues. Question is it good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? That's a very important question, public policy questions. All of which is the subject of a separate lecture. And as I pointed out, it has long been my conviction that the spiritual needs expressed and the questions raised by modern religious women concerning their standing in Jewish law should and can be tackled seriously, respectfully, and sensitively. However, it is only from the position of scholarship and earnestness that we can be sure that our queries are valid and confident that our creativity will not violate the rubric and guidelines of halacha. The talk this evening has been an attempt to elucidate with you, and I realize that for many of you have trudged through the halakhic material, but this is very important because this is how Judaism decides matters, by understanding fundamentally what are the rules and what are the principles. The Talmud spends page after page to isolate the principle. And this is what we've done this evening, understand the principle on the issue of women and minyan. Hopefully you've gotten a little bit of insight. Hope for some of you, I've taught you that women and minyan is not mutually exclusive terms, and I have to thank you all for your kind attention.
Professor Frimmer will now take any questions or from the audience.
Yes.
Why do you say that many women, they are in public, and somebody tells you the gun not fit me hard, okay? It's like never happened, because the shapsul aleidu, so how can they really testify?
It's not a question of testimony. It's a question of community. Martyrdom is a case where a Jew is called upon to affirm his Judaism. Now normally we say, if it's in private, it's not an issue. We say life comes first, because the Torah says, v'chai behem. The Torah was given to live by, not to die by. But there are times when a Jew is asked, and again it's the ideal, the Jew is asked, called upon, when there is, we're dealing with a Jewish community, and a community is established by a minyan by 10. So 10, it's not a question of testimony, it's being part of a Jewish community. Says all the schools that either because it's publicizing, because it's something that's done in public, or because women are obligated equally with men, that in fact the community has been established, this particular Jew must stand up for his Judaism and let himself be martyred rather than violent. Yes. Could you stand up so everybody can hear? Try not to be too shy.
If you're familiar with Rabbi Joel Roth's two values,
yeah.
Talk about that, about idea of obligation.
Sure. Let me begin with what we've done now is ask the obvious question. The conservative movement about 10 years ago has actually recognized the eligibility of women to count for a minyan. The question is, how do I respond? She didn't say that, but I'm telling you, I'm interpreting the question in the traditional Talmudic style. How do I respond to this particular hot potato? Okay. Firstly, my tiff with the conservative movement is not in its right to set up any rules that it likes. After all, it's an independent body. I respect the religiosity and sincerity of its leaders. And I, in fact, recognize them as important leaders in the Jewish community. My disagreement with the conservative movement is in their argument that what they did was a halachic move, that it is, in fact, in the tradition of halacha, of what has been the halacha for 2,000 years, 4,000 years. Conservative Judaism is guided by halacha. Orthodox Judaism is bound by halacha. And there's a fundamental difference. Because if you're guided by halacha, it means there are a variety of other considerations, which the conservative movement views as equally important. Sociological considerations, historical considerations, all of which the conservative movement feels are equally important to the halacha considerations. And clearly, it's the conservative movement's right to make decisions based on the way they view that. But if to argue that it is a halachic decision, based on traditional halacha, not the way they view the evolution of halacha, but the way halacha has been understood for the last 4,000 years, the paper that I presented tonight makes it clear that that's not so. Now let me just very briefly attempt to discuss the issues that were involved. The comments I'm going to make from here on in, okay, are comments that were made by conservative rabbis. In response to the move of the conservative rabbinate to include women in minyan, there's a paper in Conservative Judaism that was written in the early 1970s by Rabbi David Feldman. He was a noted scholar, wrote a book on abortion and Jewish law, very, very important book. And some of the comments I'm going to make from here on in are based on what he wrote in this article in Conservative Judaism. And in fact, I may just make you an interesting historical point. David Feldman came to Harvard in 1970 and gave a lecture at which he said that women could count for minyan for public prayer. I wrote him a letter giving him the sources that I had collected. I told him I've been working on this problem for 20 years. I gave him the sources that I had at the time. He then proceeded to retract the position and published a paper in the Conservative Judaism. And he developed the topic beautifully. There was a split that occurred. I don't know how much publicity was given. There is now a group that is broken off, and it's called the Union for Traditional Conservative Judaism, and they put out several pamphlets. One that's called Tomech Kahalacha, responsible for the panel of halakha inquiry. They too have discussed the subject of the conservative movement's decision to count women for a minyan. There was an article, okay, those are two conservative sources. There's also an article in response to the Rabbi Roth's paper that was appeared at length in Tradition, which responded to it. Okay, now that's a long introduction. Let me tell you what I'm saying. For my whole discussion, I stated the fact that we talked about 10 individuals counting for a minyan. There is an interesting view which maintains that there is such a concept as called a snif, an adjunct member of a minyan. In many Jewish communities where unfortunately they can't get a minyan, you've heard that sometimes they count nine men and a child. Okay? Child of a minor, he clearly is not obligated public prayer. But there is certain leeway in Jewish law under certain circumstances that you can count a minor to be the tenth. Now, this view is a view that was stated by Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Simcha said that just as a minor who's not obligated can be the tenth, so a woman can serve as the tenth to a minyan. That's the view of Rabbeinu Simcha. Rabbeinu Simcha's opinion is a minority opinion. He was never, ever considered seriously. I don't mean that he wasn't a serious scholar. What I'm saying is that in the issue of public prayer, it was considered a minority opinion. Even Rabbeinu Simcha never entertained that more than one could count. He's only talking about one as a snitch. He's not talking about saying two, three, four, five women can count. Yet Rabbi Siegel, in his response, in the book that was recently published together in that collection of volume, the response to the concerned movement, Rabbi Siegel bases this whole thesis that women can count to a minyan equally with men based on this concept of an adjunct member, the snif. Halacha does not recognize that as normative halacha, certainly not for more than one. And that certainly would not have been satisfactory for the conservative movement. Joel Roth, in a separate paper attempting to justify on halakhic grounds, not the right of the conservative, but that what the conservative movement is halakhically valid along the line of traditional halakhic Judaism, introduced an interesting concept. He suggests that there are situations where women can obligate themselves. Now, we know fully well that women are free from sitting in the sukkah. Yet, any woman can go into the sukkah, provided she's Ashkenazi, as far as you can. Ashkenazi women can go into a sukkah and yes, say, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Asher Kidshanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu Leishev HaSukkah. Blessed are thou, Lord of God, who has commanded us to sit in the sukkah. How does the woman say she's been commanded to sit in the sukkah? After all, she's not been commanded. Says the Rabbeinu Tam, this is the 1000s already, Rabbeinu Tam says, she has been commanded. She's been commanded optionally. No, that's a very important distinction. How do I know that she's been commanded optionally? Because if a woman, if I'm commanded to do something and I do it, do I get reward? Of course. If I'm not commanded and I do it, why should I get reward? Yet a woman who does any mitzvah that she's not obligated to do gets heavenly reward. It means that she has related to, if a goy, a non-Jew, sits in the sukkah, does he get reward for being in the sukkah? Of course not, because he has no relatedness to this mitzvah. Yet a woman that is related to the mitzvah because she gets reward. She's doing the divine will. That is that she has related to this mitzvah. Therefore, she can say vitzivanu. Okay? She has essentially opted to do that which she wants. The Torah gave, God gave this mitzvah of sukkah. Men must do it, women can do it. Should a woman opt to take the obligation upon herself, she can say vitzivanu. Does that make her obligated? I ask you, does that make her obligated? No, it doesn't make her obligated. She's not more obligated now than she was. Before it was optional, now it's optional. God commanded us to keep sukkah, giving the woman the option to do it or not to do it. But is she obligated because she says, I'm not going to do it? No, she's not obligated. But Joel Roth slept on this issue. He said, well, I can bring the obligation upon. Sure you can. I can decide to give the Internal Revenue $500. Does that make me obligated to give the $500? If the Internal Revenue audits my books and finds out I owe the $500 back, yes. And let's say thank you, and let's give me the $500, because I was never obligated. If I should give it to you as a gift to the government, I'd be happy to take it. But not as an obligation. I'm not obligated to do that. I can do it if should I want to do it. But Joel Roth goes one step further, and it says, look, there are certain obligations like the blowing of the shofar, which women for generations have done. Jewish women, though not obligated to the shofar, are very careful about going to the synagogue to hear shofar, and all glory to them. To the point that the codifier said that they are, in fact, almost obligated, that they are obligated to hear shofar. Why are they obligated to hear shofar? Not because they're obligated to hear shofar, but because they've taken an oath upon themselves to hear shofar. Now, there's a big difference. If I say, and now this is something in halakha that makes all the difference in the world. If I take up myself an oath to every morning to get up at 5:30 in the morning to learn Daf Yomi, to learn the daily pledge in the Gemara, that, or to take an oath upon myself to stand on my head for 15 minutes. Am I obligated to stand on my head for 15 minutes? Yes! Because I've taken an oath to do that. And it makes no difference what I took the oath to do. I'm obligated because I took an oath. But is there a biblical obligation to stand on my head? There's the fact that I took an oath and I'm now obligated to stand on my head. Make it biblically obligated? The answer is no. Not biblically obligated from the respect of that I have to stand on my head, but biblically obligated because I took an oath and I have to keep my oath. Now, all that, you think, that help you follow this, because it's a very important distinction. When women took upon themselves, now I'll tell you what the difference is. Because there are rules of getting out of oaths. If a person took upon himself an oath that he can't fulfill, suppose the person, Nachman HaSan, was ill, with a middle ear defect, and every time he stands on his head, he throws up. He can then go to a Jewish court and say, Rabbi, when I took upon myself to stand on my head, I didn't realize I would have this middle ear disease, illness, and I therefore I can't keep the oath. Will you free me from this oath? And the Jewish court can free him from this oath. Can any man go to a Jewish court and says, Rabbi, I'm sorry, I can't go to your shofar today? Can a woman do that? Yes. Because she's not obligated to your shofar, she's obligated to keep her oath. Now the same thing is true with everything that I've mentioned as far as meaning is concerned. If a woman should be punctilious and careful about going to minyan, to public prayer every day, that doesn't make her obligated in public prayer. She may have accepted an oath upon herself to go to public prayer, and she's obligated to keep the oath. But she's not, we cannot become obligated in public prayer. Now this distinction is extremely fundamental, it's extremely important, and that is the refutation to Joel Roth's position. Because he doesn't make the distinction between the type of obligation that one has. And again, I want to make it very clear. The conservative movement has the right to do what the conservative movement sees fit. It's an honorable organization. It leads the Jewish community in all aspects of Jewish life. But on the question of analysis and truth, of understanding the Jewish law, all I can say is that for myself, for my understanding of what halakha has meant, and has meant for the last 4,000 years, women do not count for meaning for public prayer. I have not said this again, though I concur with it. It has been said by the rabbis of the conservative movement itself. In fact, Rabbi Feldman, on several occasions, has said, instead of saying women should count for meaning, that what the rabbis, in order to be conservative rabbis who should have been inconsistent, should have said, we now obligate women in public prayer. That would have automatically made them out of the count for me. But the conservative movement did not see fit to do so because for its own considerations. I think I've said enough on that topic. I hope they don't hang me in the streets. Go ahead. Yes?
Two reasons for the leading this law are people who are feeling that common idea, suggestion. It was. Suppose that someday down the future, the Halakhic authority should decide to, expand or modify, or the obligation, where women are excluded from the obligation for public meetings. How about the idea that during the active childbearing years, the time that maybe the first pregnant, when your last one's grown up and gone, she's free then, but prior to
the woman's divorced or not married or all those things.
And they make it obligatory during that period.
Okay.
You're living alone while you're comfortable.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Would it be possible? Yes,
would that be a legitimate thing if the order was decided to
die? Okay. Personally, I think that suggestion is a good idea. Okay? But the halacha as it stands now, and this now gets into the question of how to change halacha. Okay? And unfortunately, we don't have a Sanhedrin. I mean, remember, this is a rabbinic institution. I need a Sanhedrin to change this rabbinic institution. I can't change it by fiat, or because even I would like to. And in fact, this suggestion which you mentioned in Blue Greenberg's idea is way mentioned way before Blue Greenberg. In fact, there's good precedent for it. For instance, I'll give you a biblical example. That doesn't force such a thing. I mean, let me just sort of summarize what she's saying. She said, wouldn't it be possible for the rabbis to change the law such that a woman would be freed as long as she has these obligations to her family, she would in fact be freed, as you've said. But what about the idea before she's married or after she's grown, her children are all grown, or if she's widowed or divorced and she's not in a family framework, why shouldn't she be able to count for me? Okay, now the position I've maintained describes the status quo in halacha. You've touched on a very, an open nerve. I mean, it's a very problem about how to change halacha. And that there are methods, and unfortunately, with the absence of the Sanhedrin, and without the absence of Jewish unity, the problem is revealed. I think it's a good idea. Let me just give you a precedent to that. You may know that by the laws of kibud of the aim, honoring your parents, there are two types of commandments. Those are positive commandments, in which you have to help your father, parents, feed them, clothe them, give them baths, rahman al-fan, if necessary, to care for them, support them. Anything that's positive is a positive commandment. There are also negative commandments, which show respect, not to contradict your parents, not even to sit in their place, not even to agree to your father. If your father says something and he's not even to discuss with somebody else, you can say, Dad, you're right. You know why you can't? As if your father needs you for approval support. So the rules, the negatives to show respect, and the positives show respect, and also, positive to help your parents, those are called kavanas mogul. Now, a woman, when she's married, is freed. That is, her family obligations come first with regard to honor her parents. She has to show respect, and she can't contradict her parents, she can't sit in their place without their permission, she can't do anything that diminish their respect, but she doesn't have to run over to her father's home if her husband objects, or if her family, if the peace of the family is at stake. She's free from that, but biblical obligation. Yet if she's widowed or divorced, or she's not married yet, right, the obligation does not fall upon her. So you already see that in the Torah's view, the distinction that you just made is already present. That is, while the woman is married, the family comes first, even to free you from certain biblical obligations. I mean, honor your parents was considered one of the most lofty commandments possible. So you're asking me whether that could not be a model for the rabbis as far as public prayer. I think that would be a good direction to go in, provided we have the mechanism to do so. And while we're still, as long as we can clear now that this discussion is in theory, because in practice, we don't have the modus vivendi to change the law as it stands.
Two quick questions, if I may.
Sure.
One is, why is there a difference between Ashkenazic and Sephardic women sitting in a sukkah? And the other is, if you have a meal where there were three women and two men, should the women then separate themselves from the men to make the
difference? Excellent. Okay. Both questions are excellent. In everything, it's very complicated, but let me try to give you as briefly as possible. By the way, this is the nature of this talk. I've mentioned like 70 different rituals, touching on different rituals, and each one has its own unique problems. It was the difficulty of writing the paper, which appeared in tradition, but let me try to be brief as possible. Question, the difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardi. The Ashkenazi gave this explanation that I mentioned, that since women are obligated optional. Okay? The Asvardim say that the word Vitzivanu means obligated. You must do it. And for a woman to say it would be a lie, because she's not obligated to, in the sense, mandatory, in the normal sense of the word. Therefore, the Svardim, Rav Avadya said, is very insistent. The Svardi woman cannot make brachot, say Asher Kishon Mitzvotah Vitzivanu, when the fulfillment of the mitzvot that they are not obligated on. Now there's a dispute again in some Sephardi poskim. There are Sephardi poskim like the Rav Chaim David Azulai who says the Sephardi woman can do it. But the modern, let's say, public policy, party line among Sephardi poskim is that women cannot, like the Shulchan Aruch said, the women cannot say that Tzivanu and Mitzvot that are not obligated. The second question you asked me is a very much more interesting one. I said that it was not normative in the Jewish homes the three women got together to make a zimun. That was true until about 25 years ago. The Bnei Akiva Ulpanot, that is the Bnei Akiva, these are modern Orthodox Zionistic schools in Israel, where they have girls' schools. The girls do, in fact, do a zimun, mezuman. The three women get together, they say, Virotai Nevarech. Right? we should neverek. They built the whole brick of the Amazon with three women. In a particular case of three women and a man at a sitting at a table, now this fortunately or unfortunately happens to me all the time. In my home, I have three women, I have four children, Baruch Hashem, three girls and a boy, and with my wife, I have two girls who are bat mitzvah, and they do a zimun all the time. And my son and myself, have to just sit there. Now, the rule is the following. Rabbi David Orbach wrote a very important Halichot Beita. It is an excellent text, which unfortunately has not been translated into English. And he is the nephew of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who is the one of the noted codifiers in Jewish law in the modern state of Israel, Shlomo Zalman Orbach. He quotes his uncle saying that when you have three men and a woman, three men and a woman, three men and two women, or the men lead the zimun and the women answer. They don't count to establish the quorum, but once the quorum is established, the women answer. Similarly, three women and two men, they don't count to establish the quorum, but once the quorum is established, the women lead and the men answer. That comes from good authority. Yes?
Would you comment on the institution of Bat Mitzvah?
Okay. There are three fundamental views, yes, no, and maybe. And, I would say, okay, the consensus opinion is that Bat Mitzvah is a wonderful institution. How you fulfill it depends on your religious persuasion. In the Orthodox community, there is essentially no nothing's done in the service per se, but the girl will very much be involved. She may give a Dvar Torah at a Kiddush. There will be a great to-do made, but an educator properly, and she may say Shechianu. There are a variety of things that can be done. The consensus of modern authorities is that the institution of Bat Mitzvah, although there were some doubts that it might originally come from the Christians as a kind of sort of a confirmation service, that overall it is good for the Jews, that it should be reinforced, and is a step in the right direction, because nowadays we realize that women's education is as important as men, and that it is important to emphasize it at a young age, and what better than to make a hullabaloo about the fact that she in fact is now obligated in mitzvot, and we as the Jewish community recognize this and support it.
How comfortable are you with the rationale of the obligation for the novelist that has the exclusive reason for exempting women from the corporate of the government?
You're asking me to be honest. That's not always easy. The question was that I gave the rationale as why women are freed from public prayer worship and from many of these commandments because there are women's obligation in the home. The answer is, I'm convinced that that's about 80% of the reason. I'm not totally happy because of the objection that you raised, because we have the model of Kibbutz of the Aim, which says that when a woman is no longer married, that is, the direction that you want to go in is what bothers me about the modern situation, about the present situation. Okay? That is, there are situations where women doesn't have obligations in the home, when the children are out of the home. And yet we don't make a distinction. But I sleep well at night. Because there is a halachic construct for those who are acquainted with Jewish law that's called lo plug. Now lo plug, and it comes all the way through Jewish law, means that when the rabbis set up edicts, they didn't say, this in this particular case we'll do it this way, in this particular case we'll do that, and then set up 17 different exceptions. No, Jewish law doesn't work that way. When I set up a rule, I set up across the board. And across the board is when except women, because in most of their life, they are involved with the family, either as mothers or as grandmothers, okay? Or as children in a homework family. And the rabbis wanted to give women flexibility. Now, again, remember that in giving them the flexibility, my father shlitim, and they live a good long life. My father said, every important decision involves a sacrifice. And the rabbis having to decide whether women would be free from public worship, which was a sacrifice, because public worship is very central to Jewish life. Or to choose, say, we can't force them out of the home, we have to give them the option to stay at home without guilt. The rabbis opted to say, both are important, we have to make a decision, we'd rather sacrifice public prayer so the woman could stay at home. Okay, so I think that the argument of Lo Plug is a valid one. If you ask me what direction I would like to go, I'd like to go in the direction that you suggested. There's a mechanistic problem of how to do so, the problem. But I think that the situation as we have now, it may not jive with the modern reality, but I'm not so sure the modern reality is the ideal situation. There was a beautiful long article written by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the book that was published by a women's opener in Israel called Amana. And in this booklet he says, he's of the position that he's not so sure history is moving in the right direction. He's not sure that everything that we assume as modern and 20th century is good. I think that we realize that women's liberation is important, it represents a value, but it comes at a sacrifice. I think the women's liberals of the 50s, the 60s and the 70s are aware of that problem. Many of them are opting to go back in the home. I think it's more important than anything else that we, as committed Jews, be aware of the fact that a woman who opts to maintain a traditional Jewish role are to be given support, because Jewish life has always stemmed from the family. And we shouldn't say that to decide to be a traditional Jewish role, that's naive. I think there's a lot of stability that's been lost in the Jewish home. I think that history will not necessarily judge the breakdown of the family and women's lib completely favorably. I think we have to keep our eyes open. Women's liberation has done many things. It's liberated men, made them aware of women as human beings, as people that they have to share with, as what the nuptial bracha says, talks about re'im ahuvim. When you talk about the husband and wife relationship, we talk about re'im ahuvim, lovers who are friends. And the rabbis and the homiletical says, why are they called lovers who are friends? Because true people in love are lovers, and the nature of a lover is to give all to the other, to sacrifice one's self-identity. And that's why they have to be re'im ahuvim. Friends, support, help each other. They're also critical. They also stand apart. And that should be the nature of a marriage relationship. That I think to some extent that's what women's lib has done to some extent. If taken to its extreme, it's in many cases destroyed the family. I think that there are some serious problems here, which we have to deal with in a mature fashion. I don't think the jury is out yet on that particular issue of the value of the transformation. There have been some good, some bad. But I think it's important to maintain that the Jewish family has the unit, and the woman who represents the core of that unit, as an educator, as a sociologist, as a psychologist for her children, has played a very crucial role and should continue to play a crucial role. You can't turn history back. the world continues. But I think that the current sensing of the priority that the woman plays in the Jewish home and stability